the Schizo Culture Conference was, I mean, just to kind of get that over and done with quickly, was this conference organized by a French kind of editor and philosopher, Sylvain Lautringer.
Lautringer.
Okay, I always defer to your French pronunciation, Jem. You may have to remind me a few times as the show unfolds. Yeah, at Columbia University, around 115th Street in New York City, that took place on the 13th to the 16th of November 1975. So pretty much halfway through the couple of years that we are focusing on in some detail in this current series of Love is the Message, 1975 to 1976. Lautringer would go on to become probably best known for his for editing the journal Semiotext, which, you know, he starts to do during the years that we're going to be covering today. And the kind of the wider excitement about this is that it was Lautringer, who was, I don't know, arguably the figure who took it upon himself to try and introduce French post-structural theory into the United States. So this is, you know, this is big territory for us, because it's kind of, you know, it's about a lot of the kind of theoretical concerns that we both share and that you've written about very extensively, Jem. And as it happens, this is this moment captures the way in which the European philosophy, post-structuralist philosophy in particular, was kind of making its way and finding a resonant home in New York City. So in other words, something was going on in New York that seemed to kind of somehow capture, articulate what was going on in French cultural theory more or less simultaneously. The backdrop, as we know, and as we've been spending, you know, quite a lot of time on in this series in particular, was that New York City had entered into a kind of period of crisis, at least economically, with the city going effectively bankrupt earlier in 1975. This, as we've discussed in some detail already, came about in many respects because of the shift that was, you know, going on in the Western world more generally from a Fordist or industrial economy to a post-Fordist or a post-industrial economy, which led to, you know, some difficult adjustments in terms of balancing books, as, you know, in manufacturing effectively went in decline and a tax base went in decline. But at the same time, this shift also coincided with, again, something we've had touched on, but we'll be doing much more so in this episode, a sort of shift in politics away from some of the faith that people had in the kind of the mainstream political structures of society to more alternative structures, and counterculture being an obvious, you know, key example of this, and also cultural changes going on in cultural theory. Those changes sort of more or less kind of capture a shift from, you know, what sometimes are referred to as sort of, you know, this is maybe postmodern talk a little bit, but that, you know, grand, you know, theories that kind of follow a grand narrative, if you like. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They're teleological. So, you know, classically Marxism, of course, but, you know, you can also cite, you know, Christianity and Judaism within these grand narratives. Freudianism comes, and psychoanalysis comes within these analyses, is kind of how the psyche develops from, you know, birth through to death, etc. And, you know, in parallel with these grand narratives, there's also this heavy emphasis, mainly in the 50s and 60s in particular, on structuralism. On the idea that the world can be understood through all of these kind of, you know, by putting everything into kind of structures that kind of capture the essence of, you know, famously linguistics through the study of semiotics and other structures that can, you know, help us understand the world. And this, you know, these structures were kind of almost naturally aligned with the kind of, you know, industrial society, which itself was very highly structured and organized and hierarchical. But it was in, you know, it was with the rise of post-Fordism, the breakdown of the industrial economy, that this kind of, you know, new ways of social organization and economic organization started to come into being. And so did, you know, new modes of thinking. And in particular, this was reflected in France with figures such as Foucault and Derrida, Deleuze and Guattari, which I'm sure we're going to return to and you'll tell us more about as well. And, you know, in the post-structuralist experiences, again, we've touched on somewhat already, could be seen to be being expressed within the way that people wanting to lead their lives, you know, from young people just not want, you know, going into counterculture and wanting to avoid the kind of 9-to-5 routinized, you know, lifestyles of their parents, to, you know, the emergence of kind of more flexible styles of living and entertainment, of which DJing was this kind of really interesting kind of expression. So all of these are things are up in the air at this particular moment, and they kind of, you know, they get to be into, to some extent brought together, partly by Lautréamont and his you know, his fascination with French theory, and what would go on to be a really interesting engagement with the kind of New York City culture and party scene, to which we'll be returning a little bit later. That's what we're focusing on.
Well, that's a good account of what's going on at the time. I think it's worth stressing that although it's taking place in the elite university, Lautréamont definitely saw this as a sort of countercultural convergence, this conference. It wasn't just an academic conference where people would come and give papers. So there were artists involved and it had a very bohemian character. It's an interesting to think about the parallels or the differences between Deleuze and Guattari, these Parisian French philosophers, who I think for a lot of people in France are the philosophers of 1968 and its immediate aftermath. Their reception in the English-speaking world, especially the American universities, and that of some of the other compatriots and cohorts and contemporaries who would become big names of, you know, capital F, capital T, French theory or French philosophy, over the 80s and 90s. So the person who really becomes the most famous in the English-speaking world, or the two who become the most famous, are Foucault and Derrida. And Foucault's a bit sui generis. It's a bit his own thing. He's sort of this kind of radical bohemian figure, but he's slightly older than all the others. He's also associated with a certain movement to develop the history of ideas as a discipline in the English-speaking world and in France. And then Derrida is the one who really becomes the huge name in the 80s and 90s. But that's because he's taken up by elite literary scholars in American literature departments. He's famously gives a paper at a conference at John Hopkins in the late 60s that blows everybody away, that sort of is seen as announcing the end of what had been the sort of moment of structuralism. And then he's taken up by a number of followers in the English department at Yale in the 80s, which is really what comes to define in many ways the reception of this whole generation of French philosophers. And so what happens by the 90s and 2000s is you get this quite strange situation where this group of Parisian philosophers who don't necessarily see themselves as having a huge amount to do with each other. I mean, they do. I mean, they're all part of this Parisian radical scene, this post-68 radical scene. And they're roughly similar ages. They all know each other. A lot of them hang out together. But there are significant differences between all their positions. They all end up being described with these categorical labels like post-structuralism, which they themselves don't really use. That's really a function of the way in which they're really primarily read in literature departments. This is like the end of the historical period that begins in the 40s, when English literature is like the central subject of the humanities in the American universities that have expanded because of the GI Bill and then the further expansion of universities in the 60s and 70s. And Derrida becomes huge basically because he's a philosopher who writes about literature. So if you're someone who has a job in an English department, but what you'd really like to be is a philosopher in the continental European style, then you can read Derrida and write about that. But Deleuze and Guattari remain these very marginal figures, even though in France, Deleuze is definitely much more famous than Derrida, and Guattari probably is as well for most of the time he's alive. But they're really marginal figures. And to some extent, they remain associated with this milieu which Lautréamont sort of establishes in the States, which is embodied by his semiotext imprint. It's this sort of intellectual demi-monde which is more connected to the gallery scene than it is to university departments. It's connected to various sort of cultural institutions. It's sort of para-academic. But it's very difficult for people to get sort of proper academic recognition for this kind of stuff until the late 90s. Like Deleuze and Guattari, when I was doing my master's degree, when I was at what Americans would call grad school, like studying critical theory in the early 90s, like Deleuze and Guattari, in Britain, like Deleuze and Guattari were still considered quite suspicious. They were treated quite suspiciously. They were thought of as being a bit kind of wild-eyed figures who might have taken everything a bit too far. That's partly because we'll talk about this on the show today. They were seen as breaking with Freudianism, and Freudianism became a sort of religion to a certain cohort of left liberal intellectuals, both in North London and in Manhattan, actually.